Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects, the place where contemplative Freemasons from around the world can join together temporarily and deal with some of the loftier questions that are meager questions that cross my mind after I listen to you and after reading. It makes me wonder. This week, I think we've got an interesting commentary entitled Acknowledging Intelligence. And I think this speaks to the nature of true masonry. And I'm sorry if that offends. There are different aspects of masonry. There's some masonry that I think of as ghost masonry. You know, the notation of men hundreds of years old on our walls, and their descriptions of how they're relevant to the overall cause tends to make me think that for a lot of new people coming into the order, their bearing is so little because new people coming in are not well schooled yet. They have no history, and they haven't really been influenced by their mentors. They're just newly at the door, asking us, in effect, do I have the what it takes? Do I have the raw talent? Do I have the ability to become a Mason? And you know that our early work is about questions, and we answer those questions in an assertive way. And sometimes, for the likes of me, it was the first time that I'd really been put on the notice to commit about my beliefs, and it was refreshing. It was daunting in the same aspect, but refreshing, challenging, but necessary. And when our new fellows come to the door, they're asking the same things. We're saying to them, of course, we hope that you're made of the stuff that we think you are, or we hope that you're made of the kind of stuff that we need. But we don't know that. And then we give an instruction. You roll up your sleeves and get to work and get busy as a Mason. And that tells us that there are many different aspects. Some people may see that as a psychological release. I've been lonely, or, you know, I realize that, you know, if I hang around if I associate with a good caliber of people, it will bring out the best in me, which I think has some merit. For others, if I do acts of direct charity in my community, it not only makes me feel good, but it serves a direct purpose. And that helps to redefine the kind of person that I am. For yet others, is this the intellectual release that they've been craving all their life? This unusual opportunity to plunge into a deeper understanding of religion and philosophy. Simply by answering the questions. Or to a less extent, but nevertheless, it's a possibility. There are those who will want to sanitize a rather unpleasant and a disparate character by associating with men of some character, some merit. And it makes me wonder, if I am a ruthless businessman, if I am a shark in the political waters, and I'm successful clawing my way to the top, does a membership as a Freemason exonerate? Does it mean I should be hailed for my accomplishments, not for the harm that I've done, not for the indifference or ill manner that I bring to the world, or the aggression, but because I'm a Mason, is disguise? Is that, in that case, is Masonry a disguise for a different truth? Well, I think, yes, you've met people like that, I'm sure, in life. But the interesting thing about Freemasonry is it doesn't cleanse the conscience. There is that record. There is that accounting. You do know ultimately what you are. It takes a real capacity to disassociate on your deathbed to say all that I've done has been wonderful, that the harm that I've caused people, the chagrin that I've known, the indifference to people's feelings that I've known and ignored all these years don't matter. That takes a pretty monstrous kind of a mind, don't you think? So it's not whether we're armed with that kind of knowledge or not. There's no smugness in all of that. It simply is what it is. It's the nature of humanity. It's the nature of, not necessarily humanity. I don't want to be so bold as to make that kind of a statement. I'll leave that to the more clever of you out there. But it's more about I think, wrestling with change and potential. Function of a man's life when he begins to understand his true nature, the unvarnished nature. And that is something that a wise man seeks. You search for that, no? Only a fool would try and go through life with living a pretense. That would take a certain arrogance or a certain deeper neuroses than most of us care to admit. Now that you think about it, the contemplation, it does not mean that we strip away any sense of joy. Our efforts, however earnest, do not mean that that everybody around us is going to think similarly and pat us on the back or agree, nor is it necessary for us to create arguments with other people. Other people's opinions are equally valid. As we know through hundreds of years of accumulated work, Masons have begun, not only men have begun, not only to think and read and study, but to want to share what they've learned and their aspect, their worldview. I think that's wonderful because the hope is, I think, two parts. One is validation. I get what you're saying. I understand what you're saying, and I agree with it. Another might be, I'm not quite sure I agree with all of it. I agree with some of what you're saying. Now, those are questions that leave us the pleasure of curiosity. The L'Aquilenzo is claimed to have said that the man who puts his hand out to stop the wheel of progress risks having his fingers crushed. Interesting plumber, yeah? Thoughtful man. And similarly, the change that happens around us happens not because or against any type of governance, not the demagogue or the autocrat or fear-mongering, none of that. It happens often for reasons that we can only begin to grasp in hindsight. Because if we're living as we do in the moment, our future is that rapturous opportunity that feel immortalizes us when we're young men. Everything is possible and laid out in front of us. And as we become a little older, and it's valid all through life, equally valid is as we get older, we respect and appreciate and value certain aspects of contentment. When we realize that to achieve, we begin to limit ourselves in a way. To achieve those great things takes more time than I'm likely to have left on this earth. That's a mentor being very hard on himself. The mentor continues to contribute until his last breath. And on that, and during his last breath, he begins to see the reality of everything around him with a clarity that wasn't possible before. Because you're facing not only your immortality, but what's coming next with that pleasant curiosity. That pleasant curiosity. Today we're going to be talking about acknowledging what we are, and a rule of thumb that I think galvanizes us, and you may terribly disagree with me. When I approach you as a somewhat well-qualified stranger, or you approach me, I hope and I expect, and you do as well, that I have some manners, that I have the manner and comportment of a gentleman. And that when I'm angry or frustrated, that I conduct myself as a gentleman would, that I don't ever exhibit a lack of self-discipline. That's a hard task. But if I'm properly schooled, I'll learn how to do that. Not suppressing my emotion, but considering the different options about how I display my reaction to the world around me. And in doing that, I reflect and bring forward a level of refinement and a capacity to examine myself in the moment, my actions, my reactions. The world around is what it is. And it's quite interesting and curious and lively and dynamic. But the change, even where there is, you know, we have, even where there is the pettiness, we're not going to erase pettiness from existence. We know that. But it doesn't have to be an influence, a great influence. It's there. The trees fall in the forest. That happens. It rains somewhere, the sun's shining somewhere. But this is the congregate of people who will wake up curious to find the very best parts of the world, of the day, to search and drag out the finest aspects of existence for that day, for that moment, for that hour, the best characteristics. The rest is always there. You're an intelligent being. So you have that capacity to discern, to evaluate, to critique. And you have the intelligence to be very meager. You have that choice. But it is a choice, and you, in your, when you're, it's put to you that you have a choice. You can, it is possible to make the best of a very difficult situation. It's hard to shake off that kind of statement, isn't it? I don't like it. It's like those statements, well, you know, how much meaning does it have? It gets under your skin. I can always do better. But if I have that, if I accept that that notion, the Masonic notion of agape, that inner love of the self, then I can say it with purpose. I can always shape the note. I can always strive for that emotion that was not there. I can strive for that accuracy of decisions. I can work hard to build harmony, to construct the kind of teams and organizations that can create great things. Self-love. And I can enjoy the genius of others around me. I just want to give you a little snippet here, of course, from one of my favorite writers. This is a person I would like to sit and invite to dinner and have a glass of wine, maybe an ale, and talk. And here's one of the reasons why I'd like to talk with him, because I don't think he spoke this way, but here, two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene from ancient grudge, break to new mutiny. The opening lines of Romeo and Juliet. The Montagues and the Capulets, the heads of the clans, they carried on an ancient grudge, an ancient hatred one to the other. From ancient grudge break to new mutiny. Two, that challenged that authority, that challenged the history, that challenged the hatred and the grudge, and did it with such a dignity that to continue on the grudge would seem to dehumanize the entire process regardless. Now, who wouldn't want to sit down and talk to that man about what he was thinking or how he came, how those kind of statements are resonate with people? Why would we want to take a moment to pause, to parse out the link between each word, from ancient grudge break to new mutiny? Why? Instead of just saying it in a word, they didn't pay attention, they didn't listen. Why do we feel that we are better for the effort of listening? It makes us listen, doesn't it? It makes us reflect. So I don't think I would necessarily think, well, what was on your mind? What motivated you? I don't really care about that. It's like just, what are you reading these days? Or, you know, what plays fascinate you? What are you thinking about what's going on with the politics of the day? We come back. I'll get into the commentary. I do have to have a shout out to our listeners from South Korea, from France, from Norway, from Britain, from Australia. Thank you so very, very, very much. It's overwhelming to feel that kind of support. But more important, it's we try to provide here at Masonic Effects a service to Masons to have the kind of perhaps quiet conversation. You can yell back at me or challenge or affirm without necessarily risking the harmony of the lodge. And this is particularly helpful for those of us who have been taught that there are certain functions, there are limits to what we can and say, not limited by the thought that comes into our head. In some areas, people are brought up to think that whatever pops into their head is a legitimate comment, regardless of the impact or the negative impact on the people around them. Well, I think Masonry does stop us in those tracks and ask us to consider and reflect. And so we measure our reactions. And so as you sit there with your in your solitude with your preferred beverage or libation or a cup of good cappuccino or an espresso or a glass of clear water or a nice view around you, whether you're listening to my voice through the airwaves or, a set of headphones so it's more intimate, private. Here, I think that I picked some, thank you for your response to the music, by the way. I'm quite chuffed about that. Today we have, we're going to start with a piece that's very, I don't know, sets the right tone, I think, for what we were getting into today. We'll get into a little bit more of Thomas More. Thomas More, that utopian dream. So as I talk to the dreamers out there amongst the dreamer within each Freemason, here's a little bit of music for the dreamer, Le Pleurplis de Chabert. This is from the French Jazz Project. I think you'll like it. Thank you. Captured the moment for us, gentlemen. Ah, what more is there to say? Here, the 12 labors of Heracles. It's the opening few words of the commentary today on acknowledging intelligence. The 12 labors of Heracles, or Hercules, as we know, may know him, are a series of episodes concerning penance carried out by Heracles, the greatest of the Greek heroes, whose name was later romanized as Hercules. They were accomplished over 12 years at the service of King Eurystheus. When I think about guiding our apprentices, in a way we are imparting knowledge of a sort for personal development. Over the years, our Masonic libraries have accumulated collections of opinion pieces. Some are more valuable than others, a status we gladly grant begrudgingly to experts amongst us. Age gives credibility. So does rank. Both have more to do with a sense of celebrity than validity. Both have more to do with a sense of celebrity than validity. For hundreds of years, a celebrity of the day has been dragged out to convince people by virtue of their recognizability that there is merit in what they are saying. Completely fallacious, yes, but it feeds a habit. What sections as exist within the Masonic corpus generally explain our means justify the ends. Teleology. Masonic ethics is consequential. It's the only opposing notion left to us. Deontological. The morality of an action are independent of the outcome. So what is the use of this for the likes of me? To understand this purpose, we need to look into an interesting branch of Greek philosophy, eudaimonism. It is uncanny that eudaimonism contains so much that is at the heart of Masonry. When you reflect on learning through the accomplishment of demanding tasks, what does it say to you? A respect of intelligence and beauty opens the mind. It opens the mind. Here. From a person, this is a singer, Anna Vidovic. She's Lithuanian. And again, as I mentioned earlier, Lithuanian is one of the oldest language in the face of the earth, right? Spoken. Here. Listen to this. Beautiful guitar. brilliant. Can I drag our conversation sideways a little bit today? This is I feel like I'm quite in a free fall. We're 24 days from solstice, beginning of winter, for our friends at the top of the earth in Australia, and beginning of summer for our friends at the top of the earth in Scotland and Norway and Canada and the likes of that. Interesting that we have, in the background, always there would be this notion that there's men like us in different parts of the world thinking like us and enjoying the camaraderie and the intellectual pursuit, always at the risk of becoming quite ponderous and boring, always the recipient of criticism for everything that can be ascribed to men of that culture, always. And yet we have people, very gentle and thoughtful people, well-mannered Masonic gentlemen. It's important to me. It would be important to our mothers, I think, that are delicate in their understanding of the world around them. One of them, I'm going to read something. This a Canadian wrote this, which makes me kind of pleased, of course. As gold exists in the dark earth long before the miner's pick bears it to the light of day, so all the truths revealed to man in the past and to be discovered by him in the future are eternal. Thank you, Manly P. Hall. Thank you. Thank you. As gold exists in the dark earth long before the miner's pick bears it to the light of day. Made me stop and think. It's the tone, it's the atmospheric thought that introduces a bit of work by a really interesting man. Really interesting man, an accomplished man, and a man who I think died with a feeling that life was incomplete. Mm. They're the kind of men that I can seem to relate to. I'm not really good around the geniuses or people that love to hear themselves talk. I was raised and influenced by an old mentor, my grandfather, who pointed out how to determine if a man liked to hear himself talk. And then he left it to me to decide what that meant. You would like to hear your own voice instead of being able to hear it. And what he was telling me, again, as a little boy, was how to listen. How to listen. One of the skills that we is underlined in our order, how to listen. Pythagorean, huh? His school. You and I, when knocking the door, we had nothing to contribute. So we weren't listened to. You sat and learned. You paid attention. You learned the formula. You learned the mathematics. You learned the philosophy. You learned the geometry. But you listened. Because you were a sponge. As one of my most beautiful professors I've ever met, Alexander Brody, would say, you have nothing to contribute, but don't feel bad about it. You're not stupid. You're students. Student. You're not expected. When your learning is complete, then you take on the responsibility of making a contribution. Until then, respect that you're a dilettante, that you can challenge based on just that spark of an idea, not the complete knowledge of it. And Pythagoras offers you and I, the hint of Pythagoras offers you and I the same opportunity. This man never calls his idea of existence of common themes in the numerous ancient religions and cultures of the world by a particular phrase or term. Campbell would call them, you know, that finds that statement of bliss, find your bliss. Let's see if Pike is referencing something along that line. For ease of reference in this volume, Pike's concept is referred to as his unity concept. That's what really sparked my interest, unity concept. And the evidence it strongly suggests one of his main purposes for writing it all was the presentation of this concept. Others, and yes, this is embarrassing, but that, you know, I'm sitting here studying Utopia, Thomas More's work, and so I'm unabashedly referencing people who have been influenced by that, and pretty soon we'll be talking about Machiavelli, just because I've been reading more about and studying and learning more about that. I'm sorry, I'm a simple person, I know. But he was sharing his idea of unity in the belief systems of early mankind. And he brought up Thomas More, for instance, commenting on the religion of the fictional utopians, observes their different beliefs on matters of religion. Are you all sitting up, fictional utopians? But all utopians agree with the wiser of them that there is only one supreme power, that is the maker and ruler of the universe, whom they call Mitra. They do differ, however, as to who he is. Some think he is one God, while others another. Whatever God each person believes is the chief God, they agree that God is the very being whose power and majesty and supremacy over all things is attributed by universal consent. Common sense, natural law. So in this work, it's an attempt to unify the religious thought of the ancient world entirely consistent with the intellectual focus of the time. And this is looking at the works of Max Müller. He was around between 1823 and he passed away in 1900. And Sir William Jones, and he was around a little earlier, 1746, and he died about 1794. And they were demonstrating the linguistic unity of the major European languages with those of Persia and northern India. Now, Mr. Pike thought, read this and studied this and thought ideas relating to the deity were transmitted along with the language. And he uses the common concept of light as a symbol of God in the ancient Aryan, Hindu, and Greek religions to demonstrate this. Though certainly many of the connections made in the late 18th and early 19th century were oversimplified and occasionally even wrong. But substantial thesis of linguistic and therefore philosophical and religious unity is difficult to deny. There is always a sovereign power to whom belongs the maintenance of the order of the universe. Among the thousand gods of India, the doctrine of divine unity is never lost sight of. Forever in all the nations ascending to the remotest antiquity, we find seated above all the gods a still higher deity, silent, undefined, incomprehensible. The supreme, one God, from whom all the rest flow or emanate, or by him are created. And once this central purpose is understood, many of the confusions that beset the casual reader can be avoided. One need not know in detail the mythologies to which he refers or the specific attributes assigned to particular deities by their devotees. It is only necessary to understand that it's being used as an example of man's early, nearly universal attempt to express the inexpressible. Now, I find very strong parallels with a comprehensive understanding of our order. It's almost inexpressible. Every time you offer a brilliant expose, a brilliant piece to help me understand, reach a deeper understanding, it leads me to the next and the next and the next. And I can't speak with you about this without reveling in whether we need a conversation about Greek philosophy or the Essenes or the Kabbal. And it's like, it's stunning. Like, why does that happen? Why does masonry not seem to give me one simple equation yet? Because I don't see the edges of it. I don't see all of the ingredients. All that we witness is this inspiration, this limitless universe around us, this limitless curiosity within us, the inspiration, the impressions in our minds. Masonry is the universal, eternal, immutable religion, such as God planted it in the heart of universal humanity. Well, if that doesn't annoy all of the powerful religious groups of the world, nothing else will. No creed has ever been long lived that was not built on this foundation. It is the base, and they are the superstructure. So even today, I feel weary about the assassinations and the murders of Coptic Christians in Egypt, told they were the first people to convert to Christianity. The first. And they're still with us. And so they're a symbol of something to maniacal groups. Do I whisper to them yet? You can kill the man, but you can't kill the idea. Put down your gun. He'll put down his eventually. An insufficient prerequisite, the theoretical unification of the ancient knowledge itself. Insufficient. Such knowledge may be a single coherent body of truth that has transcended limits of geography and history. But this idea, in small snippets, often hidden in the middle of lengthy discourses, and something like this, the aeons of the agnostics, the ideas of Plato, the angels of the Jews, and the demons of the Greeks, all correspond to the furores of Zoroaster. Primitive Christianity was no new religion, but the reproduction of the oldest of all. And its true and perfect morality is the morality of Masonry, as is the morality of every creed of antiquity. A bit daunting, yeah. Whether one wishes to accept this thesis as unity of ancient religions is your decision. Whether the evidence is convincing or not, less arguable is the great degree of mutual influence that characterizes the ancient world. It still influences. And rightly, it points out that the Hebrews incorporated Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Phoenician, Chaldean, and Greek thought with their own. And the Greeks in turn borrowed freely from the Egyptians and the Persians, and the Romans built upon their cultural, agricultural deities and mythic heroes an elaborate pantheon derived chiefly from the Greeks, but interlaced with the Egyptian and Persian deities as well. We can assert Enoch from the Bible was Hermes from the Greeks, and Hermes was the Thoth of the Egyptians, and Agni of the Hindu. And given such religious cross-fertilization, it's understandable that Philo sought for Plato in the Old Testament and Aquinas looked for Jesus in Aristotle. What sections exist within the Masonic corpus generally explain our means and justify the ends? Is this enough? Quite enough? I like to think so. Here, let me top that up for you. It's as we've been sitting and talking, you've been sipping away, and I'm being an incomplete host if I don't make sure that you're satisfied and that our company is curious. Here, while I go and get you something.
C'est mon cœur, c'est là que je viens retrouver mon âme, toute ma flamme, tout mon bonheur, oh, quand je revois ma petite église et mariage, un aiguillement.
refreshes the oxygen in the room, doesn't it? Just that's the Avalon Jazz Band. I've heard them before on the show. Universal Music, been always trying to think about what that, it always puzzles me, what that would be, the music that most of us can would find toe tapping or soothing. And around the world, I don't know if there's, I think there's jazz for sitar, different phrasing, different math, yeah. I wonder if they, well, yeah, I've heard jazz bagpipes. Yeah, of course. I'm sitting here looking at a book that I picked up in Edinburgh on the 15th of October in 2008. I was over there. What was I doing over there? I was over there on vacation. Yeah. I picked October because, of course, I wanted it to be the typical. I wanted to smell the air. You're so close to the ocean where we were, and to feel the change in the atmosphere that would happen in a matter of a minute, to feel that mist and then the sun break through and then look at what was going on, people walking around with purpose and in earnest. It reminded me very much of a university campus. Do you know where, if you're there, you see everybody walking with purpose, or if you're on a military base, directed, thoughtful, but moving forward. None of this restful sort of meandering thought. Everything with purpose. It's quite amazing. And when you're with a big crowd of Masons, you find that. But it's not everywhere, but it's that notion that it should be, we're all there and we should all be in order. The qualifier for being in the room is that we are all magicians. I was taken by this small book. It's by David Stevenson. It was just riveting. Because I have been taught that the first was somewhere else. Then you begin, like everything else, you begin to study. And it wasn't like it shattered the myths. It just added an enrichment. It was like putting that Augustura bitters into my rum and with my lemon juice. Add something else. Aqua vita, you know, vitae, it just adds. But the medieval, this was really a notion about the medieval stonemasons. And I keep thinking, you know, as we're talking today, and I'm putting these challenges out to you, that we're going well beyond the metaphor and the framework of medieval stonemasonry. But one has to admit, it has so much of that universal resonance, not so much cultural, perhaps, but it has this really ubiquitous sense of time. It's talking to us about it, about time being fluid. Can you help me with this? Is time fluid or is it static? Past, present, future. Well, we've spoken about that a little earlier too. Your perspective in this moment with me allows us to look back and to look forward, but always from this position. We are never ahead of ourselves and we are never behind ourselves. And this notion of past, present, and forward exists, like history, in our imagination. The metaphor, I think, is magical and wonderful. And it's at a time when there was a religion was being traded, when commerce was much different than it is today. When natural law was prevalent, when when the world around us in medieval days was just making large steps, perhaps unknown to the people of the time. So we recognize this type of organization was profound, and it has a mythical history, and that's one of the salvations of Masonry. It has the myths to support it. Now, if you're trying to move all mythology aside in a fact-based universe, you're going to, I think, fall into a vacuum, because mythology allows us to provide answers where logic and rational thinking fails us. But perhaps you'll come back next week and we can talk about that. And the metaphor. Next week I'm looking at Dans mes rues on my street. We're looking at 24 days till solstice. What are we, the 147th day of this year? Measuring and playing with time without really having much of an understanding of what it is, but we're able to use it. I don't understand much about the kind of car that I have around me. Certainly I don't, but I understand that it takes me to some very interesting places. I don't always understand what I feel is required of me as a Mason, but Freemasonry, with your help, is transitional. It takes me places that I wouldn't otherwise have ever discovered. It's been an absolute pleasure. Come and join us here in this part of the world. We're celebrating our youthful 150th birthday coming up in July. 150 years. That's how young we are. And we bow humbly to the older cultures that you represent. And we try very much to learn and to enhance. And we're making mistakes, but we're learning as we go along, just as all cultures have. Here's a little gift from the gods, the music of Stefan Grappelli. Enjoy, and make sure you commit those random acts of kindness. Let him take you to the stars. Thank you.
Appelle-moi le jour et l'année.